And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, Rory from Santa Barbara.
Yeah. Rory alcoholic.
Rory!
Hey! Happy birthday, Kevin and Joseph. That's rad. That's awesome. And congratulations, Lynn and Kristen.
And Joanne.
Well, she didn't stand up. And welcome to our newcomers, Cindy, Kevin, Elizabeth. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My experience has been this fellowship is a resource if used, something I have to do and take part in. Will not fail you, will not let you down, will be there, and is always available and open. So I encourage you to tap into it. Thank you, Kevin, for inviting me up to speak tonight. It's funny, a couple weeks ago, a mutual friend asked me indirectly for Kevin if I'd be willing to, and the way he approached it was Saturday of the divisional round of the playoffs, and or the wild card round of the playoffs, and I was like, oh, fuck, you know. You know, really on that that line, and I was like, well, I know I'm supposed to. And then I started patting myself on the back all ready for it, like, yeah, you got to do the right thing, and you know, blah, blah. And then I finally talked to Kevin. It was 2 weeks later, and which is even better because now it's in the gap week, right? Like, there's nothing really going on this weekend. Had enough of the press conferences already, so that's good. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. And I want to thank my beautiful wife and companion for joining me. Very patient, understanding woman. I'll elaborate more on that in a bit. And Jason, a good friend of mine. We've been helping each other stay sober now for a couple years. And I really appreciate that you came out with us tonight. So some of the facts real quick. I have a sobriety date, December 19th of 2006. I have a sponsor, Patrick. He hasn't always been my sponsor, but he's been my first sponsor, and he's my sponsor again currently. And I have a few meetings that I regularly attend, most notably the big book, men's big book study of Alcoholics Anonymous called the Junkyard Dogs in Santa Barbara. Woof. It's a good book study. Very early on, those were three things that I was encouraged to get. That they are very useful to have. And what I've really found most beneficial to me in recovery around the book, which I'm a big believer in, and that it does contain our program of action, and I love the fellowship, don't get me wrong, and, you know, I think it all goes together, and I'll elaborate, but this idea of constantly going to a place where I'm learning from others and committed to going to a place where I'm delivering to others. That these are two things that are always in my life. And sometimes those are the exact same place for sure. But, you know, it was impressed upon me very early on. You know, we go to the places where the new men are coming into the doors, and that would be in our area. It's like the Rescue Mission, Salvation Army, the Sober Houses, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's very, very important. And I'm glad I fell into that lineage. You know, and before I lose the attention of the newcomers, I'll say this, you know, short and simple, if you ever decide at some point in your life you want sobriety, you know, then I suggest, you do what we do, get a sponsor and work the steps, you know, and I believe you'll have a spiritual experience sufficient enough to overcome your obsession to drink. You know, I always kind of recap real quick of what life is like right now, like what happened, you know, today, what I've been through in the last couple of days, and today was a pretty interesting day for my wife and I. We attended two memorials today, both members of our fellowship. One is still with us, which was one of the more interesting things I've ever attended. And he's got one of these great AA names. It's Irish Tony. I don't know if any of you know him or not. He's a gentleman that has many, many years of sobriety. He's terminally ill and has surpassed some expectations that the medical community has given him. And so he decided, and some very close friends decided, that we would honor Tony's life. And so we went to a memorial today with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous whose life was being honored by all of us present. And it was really impressive, right? The guy has been about recovery. And then a few, immediately following, went and grabbed our vegetable train. We headed downtown to Leadbetter Beach in Santa Barbara, where another friend of ours, Andrea had recently passed away and unfortunately took her life, and she's one of us, and she had much sobriety, and it just, you know, I don't have anything to really expand upon that, you know, it is sad, it makes you reflect a little bit for sure, there's obviously a lot of things that, if gone untreated, can catch up with us. And I don't know anything about Andrea's circumstances or story or anything. She was on fire the last time we saw her and very in good spirits. And so it was just really shocking. But in reflection, just the fact that we were completely engaged in a day of being available to other people, communicating with others, interacting with sober members of our fellowship, and the handshakes and the small talk and the hugs and the snacking and the storytelling and all that good stuff. And it was really a full day. It was really a full day. And we're driving home, and it was only like 2 p.m. and we're kind of tired. And it just seemed like even yesterday was so long ago, you know, like just yesterday, like it was that active of a day. And that's kind of been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. The more I've been around here, the more I've stuck it out. It's like, you know, these kinds of days, which are fairly normal, I think, to a lot of people, are very big aha moments to me still. So that's what today looked like. On our way home, I got a text from my son. We have 3 adult children in our house, and my son, his car, it's kind of a beater that I got him, is broken down, and me and him don't always communicate very pleasantly together, and I like to be very critical father to him at times. And we were able to just show up, patiently wait for the tow truck, get his car over to a shop, and just kind of let mechanics do what they do on cars. And I didn't have to harangue them about why, or, you know, why does it look like that? Why do the brakes sound like that? You know, I just, okay. And so, you know, and it wasn't always like that. It wasn't always like that. That's new for me. You know, I'm very capable of falling into the why didn't you and your shit ups and, you know, what's wrong with you and are you, you know, and that, I've used that on other children of mine, and it's taken years to rebuild those relationships, so. Anyway, that's what a day in the life looked like today, and it didn't always look like that. When I was, I started my drinking career in high school in Lompoc. I'm the youngest of 3 brothers. We are very close. I think we're very normal California kind of grow-up kids, you know, latchkey kids. The parents had daytime jobs that gave us plenty of time to mess around, and we kind of clicked with the other kind of half-breed kind of kids, you know, didn't know if we were punk rockers or cholos, and, you know, drank a lot of 40s and listened to hip-hop. And that was kind of the beginning of my life into drinking and using. And what I remember about drinking more than anything as a youngster is I didn't like beer. I was turned on to drinking by the guy I bought grass from, and I wasn't going to be a punk in front of everybody, right? Like, they wanted to start drinking, so I got into it. And I remember the effects produced by it, and I knew that I had found what I want. And I didn't, at the time, identify as, like, insecure or fearful. I had all these things for sure, but I didn't have that as a driving motivator. But what immediately happened is that life was really boring when I was sober. That I didn't like reality so much when I was sober. I just didn't. It didn't seem worth engaging on. I like being hammered. I like being high, and I like chasing a lot of outside issues. So that's when it all got started. One of the byproducts of my drinking is a lot of irresponsible behavior, including getting arrested, drunk in public, and DUIs. And also, I got my teenage girlfriend pregnant very early. And so when I was turning 18, on my 18th birthday, somewhere around there, she conceived. She was 15 at the time. And then so shortly thereafter this, and this is kind of a makeup of who I am as a person up to that point, was this idea of I got this. And so I remember when I broke the news to my parents, you know, Darlene's pregnant, she's having a baby, but I got this, you know, it's going to be all right, you know, and they're looking at us like, what do you mean, you know, she's a teenager, you're a dipshit, and you're going to, like, have a, you know, like, what do you mean you got this? And I joined the Marines, and, you know, and that's kind of been my MO, you know, and so we had another son, and I did 4 years in the Marines because I knew I had to kind of, you know, do the right thing, take responsibility and all that good stuff. And even my Marine Corps career was riddled with alcoholic problems, you know, DUIs. And another kind of MO of mine is to wait for that validation about my drinking, get that pass from somebody I respect. And I remember getting picked up in the drunk tank one time, and a gunny, some salty old fart, right, one of those guys that, like, look from the museum or something, and nobody ever heard him say anything, and we're in a big crowd of people, and I'm kind of getting a lot of shit, and he walks by, hey, slick man, and he slaps me on the back, and he said something to the effect of, you know, you're not really a Marine until you get picked up from the drunk tank by the colonel or whatever, the standing guard or something. And it was like my badge of honor for this guy. You know, like, yeah, that's right, you know. And it kind of made it okay. It made that drinking episode okay. I did get through my Marine Corps career, much like the book talks about. And I don't know if we all have this or not, but I think to some extent I do. You know, I'm pretty capable in my normal affairs when I'm not, you know, when I'm there, when I'm present, when I'm not using and drinking actively. And the drinking does get in the way of it. So I was a pretty good Marine. I did my job. I got to wear the rank of Lance Corporal twice because I did that one so good. And when I finally get out, you know, and it's me and my wife at the time and two young children, and we settle up in Lompoc, and I get a job. And this is when I feel like I had accomplished something. I'm back in my old neighborhood. I'm an accomplished Marine, you know, and I have a job, and I'm supporting my family. I used to walk down College Avenue to Poloni's, a little liquor store there, and I would get an 18-pack of Bud Light. And I remember how proud I was that I could walk in broad daylight. I was 22 now, and I could walk in broad daylight carrying beer legally, you know, and like this was my neighborhood, and you know, this is what I, and I like that was kind of, and I know that's kind of low for a lot of people in the stories you hear, but like to me, that was like a real big accomplishment. I was very proud of that for a long time. So my drinking career always had riddled in it drunken public DUI, drunken public disorderly conduct DUI. That was my drinking career. And what happened early on is when I would drink and have these episodes, then I would go to court, and then I would do that prayer in front of the courthouse and hope it's not too bad. It never was. It always was not too bad, and I would dismiss the fact that I prayed to have anything to do with it. And then I would kind of buckle down for a little while, start paying the rent on time again, get all the bills caught up again, you know, really build the house back up like the book talks about. Build everything back together, and the kids are playing in the front yard and throwing the ball around. And then I knew I had a paycheck that was mine. And I would plan it, and I would start plotting vengeance against people that didn't know it, coming up with all these excuses of why this. And so all of a sudden, I'm kind of mentally tracking down these days to deadline. And I knew I'm going out. I'm going out this day. I'm going to go out and have a few drinks. It's going to be justified and righteous. And then I would get a drunk in public again. You know, I mean, I was known to be found like bear hugging light poles on State Street, because if I let go, I would fall down, you know. And that was, and it's like 6:30 in the evening, you know. It's not even like people aren't even out and about yet. And that's just like, that's how I drink. And I always have, you know. In fact, I have a big thing for light poles. You know, I was, when we were kids, we were going to go to, I remember this because it was a big show. So Fugazi and Bad Religion were playing at the Anaconda in Isla Vista. And we got in the back of a buddy's truck, and being the good young alcoholics that we were, you know, we everybody had to get their own 12-pack of beer, because I ain't sharing shit. We're going to get ripped for this one. And a buddy brought a bottle of tequila. And mind you, at the time, I was getting ready for wrestling season, so I'm starting to kind of watch. So I'm significantly underweight. Not that I've ever really been significantly overweight, but I'm definitely underweight. And we're slamming drink the whole way down. And so we're hammered by the time we get there. The guys want to go to Woodstock's and get some pizza, and then they want to go to the old record store and IV. And I tell them, like, I can't leave the car. You know, I don't think this is a good idea. And they're like, no, you're good, you're good. And sure enough, man, I'm like bear hugging a light pole, and the foot patrol comes and gets me. It's like 4 in the afternoon. Parents come down and pick me up, take me home. And as a result of my parents picking me up that day, I'll touch on this real quick. This is when I was 16. They take me to a psychiatrist. And I was pissed because I remember thinking, even though I have all these problems with drinking already in my young life, there's no way I'm stopping forever. No way. That's out of the question. And in my mind, I hadn't even started. I hadn't gotten to that walk of 22 from the liquor store yet, you know, that day that I look forward to. And so I got in the psychiatrist's office, and I told him straight up. I was like, you know, I know you guys are here to help me with my drinking problem. You think I got issues? And I spoke about as clear as I am right now. You know, I thankfully had that little bit of gab in me then. And I looked at my parents and the psychiatrist and said, you know, I'm not done yet. I'll try to turn it down. I'll try to walk the line, but I'm not, you know, I'm not going to stop doing something that I haven't even in my mind yet fully enjoyed. And the psychiatrist asked me to leave the room, and I think he spent the rest of the time telling my parents a lot of what we tell people around here, you know, that unfortunately this sickness, this illness, we have to let people come to their own terms about having it. And it is unfortunate, you know. We can tell them all we want, we can encourage them, but for all the emotional pill seldom suffices. It just doesn't. My parents kind of laid off me, but I still got my consequences for the bad behavior, but I did notice a shift, and I actually thought I had won. Little did I know, you know. So fast forwarding again, we'll get, you know, I'm out of the Marines, bounce around a few jobs. I land a job in carpentry. I live in Lompoc. During this time, between this time frame, some of the experiences that I've had that really helped me identify with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is there's a line in there where it talks about having this firm decision to never drink again, and there we end up pounding on the bar. How did I get here? and you know, screw it. I'll just have, you know, off to oblivion. You know, it doesn't matter because here I am. And my experience was I worked on one block and my bus stop was two blocks down. I had to cross State Street to get there. And I was taking the bus because I was on a suspended license. And I got to my bus stop. I remember this pretty clearly. And I'm not going to drink. And I walked by the Wildcat Lounge. And then I walked by Club 634. And then I split, you know, split between the press room and I think it's either Dargan's or Joyce, whatever it is right there on Ortega. And I get to my bus stop on Anacap and Ortega. And I'm sitting there thinking, I got this. I'm all right. Well, I could probably have one drink. The bus ain't going to be here for 15 minutes. And I go to the press room. And sure enough, you know, at midnight, there I am. How did I get here? One more time. Here I am. Here I am. So anyway, and that's very common for me. You know, and I never put it together until Alcoholics Anonymous that I have no choice in that first drink. I never knew that. Nobody had ever told me that. In all the court order programs I had gone through, I never heard that explained to me about this, you know, this my body working independently of my mind in some aspects to alcohol, that I'm just trained and wired, and whatever it is, me as an abnormal drinker, I have this obsession, and the obsession is greater than my capability to deny it. And so there I am at the bar one more time. That's when I started really becoming concerned internally about my drinking. I had a few instances in a young age that came to mind, but that's when I really started thinking, you know, I'm kind of losing it here. So I'll fast forward just a little bit and talk briefly about some outside issues that I engaged in. And the only reason I do is because, you know, I think, you know, they helped me achieve my bottom a little faster. They definitely made me faster. And that's all I'll say about it. And what I remember about this time frame of my life is this is when it was despairing. This is when coming to sucked. This is when the morning birds drove me nuts and it was terrifying and I was full of fear. And I knew I wasn't cutting it as a father and I knew I wasn't cutting it as an employee. I wasn't meeting any of my arrangements, but I was still putting on the clothes and putting on the face and looking at myself in the mirror was like bringing tears to my emotions. And I would drive to work, and as I would drive to work, and I would go up one of those swings, I think it was Refugio or Gaviota, but one of those big swings on the 101 as I was heading down south, I used to contemplate just driving off. If I can get enough speed and just drive off, maybe it won't hurt so bad. Like, no, you're not going to die. You're just going to roll around and end up in the hospital, and that'll probably suck. But the fact is that my mind was contemplating suicidal thoughts. You know, we talk about in the fear inventory, the third column of the fear inventory, and some of you may not be there yet, but it says his self-reliance failed us. And I think about that a lot when I think about some of the things that lead me to the idea that, well, I should just, you know, get a case of the efforts or take my life. And I think if I've ever had a suicidal thought, I don't know that there's a greater example of self-reliance failing me. You know, that everything I depend on and know of coming from within me is coming up with that the best solution for you is to be done. And so I don't know a better example of self-reliance filling me than that. And I reflect that every now and then, especially in light of some recent things. And I don't consider myself manic depressive or anxiety ridden or anything like that. But I have my issues for sure. So anyway, I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous at this time. I have a domestic case coming out of Santa Maria courtrooms. Me and the wife at the time get separated. There's this nice little scene where God, I can't remember the commercial. There was a commercial about adult content warning. I love this commercial because it reminds me of a moment in my life. And there's this like strung out dude in the corner, and he's like just laying there with one knee up and the leg out, and he's posted up against the wall. And the dad's like, I'm sorry, you know, I love your show, but I'm going to have to block you from the kids. And he's like, that's all right, man. He's got like a tank top. He's all strung out. And that was like a glimpse of me one day. I was coming down, tore apart my kitchen, tore apart the house. I was angry. My mom had to come around the corner, take the kids home. My dad came over about an hour later to try to, you know, he came over because his son was suffering. He wanted to help him. And I wasn't listening. Didn't want anything he had to say. I was in this big, sickening pity party. Oh, the world's all fucked up. They hate me. It's all this, you know, I can't do it, blah, blah. And he said, no wonder you're a failure, as he slammed the door and walked out. And so I'm like, now, you know, I'm crying even more. It definitely hurt. And I agreed with it. And all of that was around this bottoming out period in my life. That's when it was miserable. It was despairing. I didn't have relationships with my children. I didn't have relationships with my family that were positive. I was falling apart physically and emotionally and mentally. during the same time frame around, and I'm a little fuzzy on some of the details, I have a domestic in Santa Maria. I'm on diversion in Santa Barbara. And during that course of diversion program, I get a second DUI in Ventura. And all of these things come to a head. And this is around 2006, early 2006. And the benefit of all of this happening was I got this this order to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got this court card. What I was given in, to me was an excuse. I had an excuse to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I needed an excuse, you know, but I did. I wasn't somebody that just walked in here one day because it really, really hurt, you know. And I have a brother that got sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and an uncle as well. And I remember at points of my drinking using, thinking about, oh, I should check out AA. I didn't want to step on my brother's environment. I thought he had something really good going on. I didn't want to go in there and act like I was taking something that was kind of, and I didn't know any better, you know. And I remember when I got this court card, I called my brother and another friend, Brian, and I said the same. I shared this because they both said the same thing to me when I asked them. And what I asked them was, I got to go to meetings. Can you recommend a good one? And they said, well, what's going on? I was like, well, I'm ordered to the meetings, but I really think I need it. You know, I'm really suffering and hurting inside. I'm just kind of ready to be done. I don't think life's going that well. And I said something like that to each of them. What both of them said to me is, I'm glad you see that. And I remember how that stuck out to me, that they both said, I'm glad you see that, and how important it was that I identified that I had this issue, that I identified that there was something going on that needed to be dealt with. So they recommended a couple meetings. My brother's one that turned me on to the Junkyard Dogs, and I fell in love immediately. It was like the Marine Corps in a locker room with sobriety all rolled into one. You know, a lot of chanting, a lot of tradition. It was all men. I'm not uncomfortable or intimidated by that. It was like I felt very comfortable. The other thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got here, I believed and felt comfortable with the fact that you guys knew the drinking game. I heard a guy say, you know, we didn't really have designated drivers. We had the guy that was willing to take the DUI for the team that night. Like, yeah. Like, I know that. I know that clearly, right? Like, no, I drove last night, man. I'm off tonight. You're going to... Because we knew nobody's staying sober. There was no designated driver. Like, it just meant that's the guy that's going to get locked up if it goes down. It's your turn, buddy. And I heard that in the rooms, like, yeah, that's us, you know. So I tap into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start going to meetings. And I get about 45 days dry, and I'm getting my court card signed by this gentleman at the Junkyard Dogs. He's a secretary, and one time he says, hey, do you have a sponsor? If you haven't been to the Dogs, they can be a little intimidating when it comes to this idea of working the steps and program of action and higher power and do your writing and help the newcomer. And I remember telling, like, man, you guys are pretty intense about this stuff. I don't want to let anybody down right now. I'm just trying to get my shit together. But I took his number because I kind of felt sorry for the old guy. Like, okay, you know, you're going to give your number right all desperately. All right. And I kept it. And so anyway, 45 days goes by. I'm probably feeling as good as I've ever felt in any kind of sobriety. I will share with you my reservation. My reservation was this. When I would hear about recovering sobriety, I absolutely believed that you were sober. I absolutely believed that you were sober and happy. I did not believe I could be sober and happy. I did believe that Alcoholics Anonymous would get me sober if I tried. I did not believe I could be sober and happy. And therefore, I didn't want to be sober. Because what would be the point in life if I couldn't drink? What the hell would be the purpose for me? Because that was my purpose. That was what I lived for. My paychecks were to get my little cut of it at the end of the day so I can get my 40s, get my shit, and enjoy my time, leave me alone. And I just didn't see life to any benefit without that. So about 45 days go by. I'm going to go meet somebody down south because her boyfriend's in jail, and that works good for me. And as I'm putting my key in the car door, I remember very distinctly a little voice, I don't know where it came from, whatever, saying, I have about 6 Bud Lights. Just have a few Bud Lights, maybe 6 Bud Lights. And for some reason, 6 to 10 was always the magic number in my head. I don't know why, but I always thought my drinking problem started somewhere in there, that it wasn't the first drink, and I know that I shouldn't be at drink 20 anyway. Somewhere between 6 and 10, I never had it under control. Anyway, so I go out this Friday, and we go to a place on auction. We knock back a few Bud Lights, and it's on. The weekend's on, and before I know it, you know, long story short, it's Sunday morning. I'm sitting Indian style I got these shorts on. It was funny because we just drove by, Fala's? And I always say the name wrong, but that was the store, Fala's, down in Oxnard. You know, where you can get like the Jesus airbrush shirt with Tupac on the back or something. And I had these shorts that they're like way too big for me. And I don't know what was going on, but I ended up using a telephone cord to hold up my shorts. And I was renting this little space of linoleum in a studio apartment in Oxnard, you know, that little kitchen corner they give you in those apartments, like a little half round to the corner of linoleum. My futon was there with a couple of shoe boxes and my C bag of all my stuff. This is what my life was. You know, this is when I'm 45 days, you know, clean, I guess. And so we're smoking shit, passing around an eviction notice, contemplating the three of us geniuses how we're going to beat this eviction notice. Oh, they can't kick you out for 6 months, blah, blah, blah. We don't know anything. And that's when I had my moment of clarity. That's when I had this out-of-body experience. And I say that because I don't know what else to call it. Something outside of me, that was looking at me with me, said very clearly, Rory, your life is, and it's going to only get worse if you don't do something about it. And I've never had that feeling before. I've never had that feeling before and have had a solution introduced to me. That's for sure. That's probably the difference more than anything. This particular evening was not any worse than any drinking or using evening I've had in my life. In fact, I would argue that particular evening was a success in all my historical accounts. I still had money in my wallet, albeit a couple bucks. I wasn't arrested. You know, none of my friends were arrested. I knew where my car was parked. I knew the people that I was with. Like, these were all things that I used to use as my checklist of whether or not a night was good or bad, and everything is good, and I'm having this experience. And it shook me. It shook me to my core. It was the thing I would say more than anything about that moment is there was a sense of urgency, bless you, associated with it that I couldn't deny. And I did something I've never done before. I stopped in that moment. I told my friend, dude, I got to get out of here. I immediately packed up all my stuff in my C bag. Threw it in the trunk of my car, and then I do what all the tough guys do. I called my daddy, and I want to share with you this voice, if you've heard this voice before, you know, when they answer the phone. Hello? They say, hey, Pop. What do you need, Rory? And you sense that. And I love my dad, and he's a good man, you know, and like a good father, you know, I said, I just want to come home and get cleaned up and get a night's sleep. You know, I need to change where I'm at. And he let me come home. And then the first thing he asked me after my shower when I get home, we're having a cup of coffee, says, what's going to be different? What are you going to do different? And so I got the phone number of a gentleman from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to give him a call. And I wasn't bullshitting him. And I called up Patrick. And I remember very clear what Patrick did because I tried to do it as much as possible with my guys. Are you okay today? Yeah. Can you get to a meeting tonight? Yeah. Can you meet me tomorrow? Yes. Do you have a big book? Yes. All right, let's meet at the coffee shop, blah, 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 tomorrow. And that's what happened. And very next day, Monday now, I meet up with my sponsor, Patrick, and we're at the Daily Grind in Santa Barbara. It's on the corner of De La Vina Mission, which is a pretty busy intersection, not downtown, but it's pretty decent. Definitely, the coffee shop itself is populated, right? It's a pretty good-sized hangout. We're sitting on the patio, and we got these big books, and I assume we were going to get coffee and go to a library or a park bench or somewhere pretty anonymous. And he starts like, you know, we start reading the doctor's opinion. He just starts reading, you know, top of his lungs, you know. He had lost everything, you know. Oh, I knew the man by name, but barely recognized him. And he's looking for identifiers for me. And I'm sweating. I'm like, fuck, man. All these people are looking at us reading Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm lame out here. And he puts his book down all slow and gave me my first lesson in perception. He said, I want you to think about all the times people might have seen you when you've been drinking and using. And I remember those times hugging light poles on State Street in broad daylight. I remember those times leaning up between bushes and seeing a birthday party right there because it's 12 o'clock and I'm in the middle of a park. And getting up and just putting the head down and going to the bar because that's what I did. And he was right. He said, do you think any of these people are going to care that you might be reading a book that could save your life?
Right.
And that was my first lesson in perception from that man. So within that brief meeting, we talked about steps one and two. We identified over powerlessness. We identified over unmanageability, which I now finally understand. I should say I continue to learn the unmanageable aspect of my life when I assume control at times. But more than anything about my my alcoholism and what I have to try to impose upon my life to keep this thing working. It's just not working for me. It's a question that another friend has given me that's been one of my most useful tools is, how's that working for you? You know? And sometimes the answer is, well, it's not. And then it becomes clear that something needs to change. So he sends me home with some homework to do the third step. And the third step is making that decision to turn it over and the prayer that goes along with it. And I like that my sponsor put that onus on me. He didn't mandate that we hit our knees right then and there. And I know some people do. And that whatever works for you, God bless, hats off. You know, he sent me home with that lesson for me. And he wanted me to interpret those words and understand what they meant and chew it over. And I put them in my words and I said the third step prayer. And when I was done, we got immediately into the writing. I hated the writing aspect, not because of its intent. I really gravitated and understood what we were after there, but I'm kind of lazy. Like, just as a human, I'm kind of lazy. And so physically writing was the most demanding thing I'd done in a long time. And during this whole time frame, this first 90 days, was like my body's going through this gnarly physiological, I'm no longer using shit, I'm no longer drinking, I'm doing all this writing, and I'm drinking way too much coffee. You know, I'm drinking... Like, you don't just get a large coffee, you know, you got to get like the triple shot, added shot, give me the macchiato, whatever, grande, you know, throw three more shots in there. And like, I'm drinking four of those a day, right? And that's just, I don't know. And then I can't sleep at night. You know, I share this with my sponsor, you know, he says, well, how much coffee are you drinking? Anyway, so one of the things he gives me, and I pass this on again to newcomers that might be struggling with the writing and what to, I started doing my writing at night, and I started getting some sleep, and that encouraged me to continue to do a little bit of writing every night. I eventually finished that fourth step, and I went up to the hill with him and shared that fifth step. And that fifth step did feel like an absolute weight off my shoulders, but just before it felt like a weight off my shoulders, my sponsor said to me as I finished up, is there anything else? And I knew I was given a moment right there to come clean with that anything else. And there wasn't anything else. And I don't share it in a prior, you know, in a setting like this, exactly what that specific was. But it was something that I carried with some shame and some guilt and embarrassment and fear of ridicule and all that. And I knew that I had to be rid of everything. I knew that I had to acknowledge that step humbly. And I also knew that I'd already been given the tool about fear. That when I have fear, I ask God to remove it and direct my attention. And thankfully that I've already dealt with fear when I do the fifth step, so I know how to deal with the fear within the fifth step. And I did, and I took my deep breath, and I knew God was with us because we asked him to join us when we started. And I said, well, there was that one time I, you know, and I did the little mumble job, and it was all I could spit out. And he said, all right, you know, I want you to go home and reflect. And that's where I slipped. I'm going down the hill, and I'm supposed to go home and sit for an hour and reflect silently, and instead I start getting a brainstorm. I'm going to stay out for the holidays because my kids need to see me, and I'm going to move in with her, and all these big ideas came on, and I did. And 2 days later, I'm living out of my van because moving in with her didn't work out, and I have 2 weeks before I turn into jail because they did give me the extension I asked for, and the only person I was willing to call in all this was a former dope man. And I stayed the night, and I remember as he was leaving, threw a couple lines on the table and walked out. And I don't know what it was. I did a couple lines and immediately knew I had just kind of lost everything I'd worked on the last 3.5 months. And I got up and I went to my van and I drove away, and I think I slept up at Red Rock in one of the sites. And that was my sobriety. That was on December 18th of 2006, or maybe December 17th. I'm not sure. The next night, though, I remember was the Junkyard Dogs, and I'm walking up to the dogs because I'm a greeter there, and this guy, PJ, was already there, and we started chatting. He's like, bro, you don't look so good. And you could just see, you know, for just that one little moment of relapse, you know, it was kind of like a complete disconnect, and I didn't feel good. And I was like, man, I don't feel good. And why don't you stay at my place tonight? And I'm like, the kids in college just left. I got a room. And in that night, when I went to his place, you know, I sat quietly for a good hour and reflected, and got in touch with my sponsor the next morning, and we picked up where we left off, and we recapped anything neat and necessary. And I've been sober ever since. That was December 19th of 2006. And my march since then was not... Everything hasn't been perfect, but it's been pretty damn good. I had to turn myself in for a county sentence for all those DUIs and diversions and domestic that have been kind of just bouncing around aimlessly. And I remember going to the work furlough program in Camarillo for about 2.5 months to get my time all accounted for. And when I got out of there, I was living at the campgrounds again with a buddy. And I couldn't really do that gig anymore. You know, I was that guy in early recovery, Sarah, we were talking about this a little bit. Like, I don't know about you in early recovery, but I always had a backpack that had a book and a notepad in it. I was either on a bike or walking around. And when I was on my bike, because I was on my bike and I was going to go to the beach and a meeting and possibly see him or her, like, I always had fishing poles wrapped around the crossbar and all my belongings on the bed. Like, that's just how I scooted around, thinking that I had to have everything with me all the time. It was a really weird kind of phase of my life. Kind of lost my train a little bit. But anyways, I was doing that kind of, reconnecting, and I get out of furlough, and I'm at the campgrounds again. I need to find a place to live, and I start looking at Craigslist for room rentals and stuff. And this one lady calls back, and so we meet up, and she starts asking me some of the questions. You know, are you on probation? And it's like, fuck. You know, I know I can't lie, right? I can't lie anymore. You know, I'm supposed to be honest. I said, yeah, I'm on probation. You know, I have some outstanding stuff, but it's all, you know, I'm out of jail. It's all been taken care of. And I said, look, I'm 4.5 months sober. I'm actively working a program with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been employed all this time. You know, I'm trying to put all these, but I am being honest. And I never said Alcoholics Anonymous or Program of Action. I just said that I'm really trying to get my life back on track. I have been sober. Those were, and she says to me, "Are you a friend of Bill's?" And I'd never heard that before. I was like, Bill? Yeah. And she says, Bill Wilson, are you in Alcoholics Anonymous? I was like, yeah. You know, and it was like the first time I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And she's like, this is what we call a God shot. I was like, and I still wasn't putting it together. Like, what's that? What's a God shot? You know, and she's like, well, and she started to tell me, I have 17 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'd love to give you a chance to rent this room if you meet your ends of the deal. And this was completely just some random stranger whose room I went to go interview. And she heard that I had 4 children and that I was going to be very interested in trying to get them on visitation. And we already had the visitation, but that they would come and be able to visit my. And so for that first year of my recovery, and I was renting this little room, my kids would come over in alternating weekends and spend time with me, and it was really interesting to be present in their life. You know, I lost a lot of that in those last few years of my using and drinking. So I'm reconnecting with my children. I have my meetings, mind you, and it's the Junkyard Dogs, the Salvation Army, the Men Without Legs. There's a routine here. It's kind of men only and action, 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 and then nothing. You know, I didn't really have fellowship yet, I encourage anybody new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, get in touch with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the program of recovery. It absolutely is essential, but the fellowship is where we do find a lot of that release and a lot of that excitement in life and reconnection. Mallory used to, that was the lady's name, Mallory. She used to knock on my door every Saturday. I'm going to go to a meeting. Would you like to go? And inside I'm saying, yeah, 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 please, please. And the outside said, no, I'm all right. I'm good. And that went on for months, and I kind of got a little stir crazy. And one night she says, hey, Roy, I'm going to go to that meeting. Why don't you go with me? And it was just a slightly different proposition. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go. And I started going to that meeting, and I started really, really liking that meeting, enough so that when I turned 3, I was going to take a cake at that meeting. I'd become very ingratiated in Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Barbara. And at this particular meeting, it was my 3rd-year birthday, and this lady gets up to speak. She's a 5-minute speaker, and she talks about how she, you know, would have the kids in the car and make these crazy trips, yada, yada, yada. I'll let her tell the rest of her story someday. But I just remember thinking, like, yeah, I want some of that. You know, I think I could handle that. And at the break, a mutual friend said, introduced us. And then at the end of the meeting, I took my 3-year birthday. And so I hit her up, and we went out for, I think, Denny's a couple weeks later. It was a big alcoholic sober date, you know. And it's pretty amazing, you know. It's you know, again, I'm not saying that because this happened to me, this will happen for anybody. But I do believe putting yourself in a position of neutrality, not having all those expectations. You know, the book's very clear about assuming we're spiritually fit, we can go anywhere. And I do believe being in a relationship is going somewhere. And if you ain't spiritually fit, you're going to find out real quick. It's going to happen. And what was really interesting about it was she was in the middle of she was in the middle of a college program. She had recommitted to getting educated. She had two boys around my children's age. I was partially in school, but just reconnecting. In fact, the day we met, I had just moved back to Lompoc a couple days before that, right? To be closer to my kids. And I'm now the sole custodial parent of my minor children. This is years ago. There was three at the time. And that, you know, that didn't just happen because one day I said, I'm going to go be the custodial parent of my children. Uh-huh. You know, it was patiently being accountable and present and seeing what's going on, taking care of myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, taking care of my spirituality, taking care of my commitments to them as a visiting father, and then becoming aware that my life was changing in such a way that I had to be present for them. You know, it became more and more clear that something wasn't working in their life and that I had to be close. And I just moved to Lompoc to be close to them just in case. I moved up on December 26th, I want to say of 2009, to Lompoc, 2008. I think it's 2009. Maybe it was 2010. I don't know. But I moved up to Lompoc on December 26th. My kids came to spend their week with me that they always do over the holidays. I just got a one-bedroom apartment there, and I have four children, mind you, 16, 15 down. And a week after their visit, their mother came and called me outside the apartment and said, and mind you, I had known that something was going on, although I didn't know what. And she just said, you know, can the kids stay with you? I lost my place and yada, 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 yada. And the kids had no idea this was happening. I had no idea. I had an inkling that something was happening. It wasn't be that sudden. So a week after moving to Lompoc in a one-bedroom apartment, I have four children living with me. And it was insane. And that was probably the most heavily I've ever leaned on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I put a few questions out there. I had to get a bigger apartment. I had no furniture. And all of a sudden, people were donating couches. People were giving me lamps. People came over to help me move. People were giving me dishes and dish sets, you know. I mean, it was amazing, the love that was given by Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't deny it. And sometimes I forget about those little bits of sequences that took place. And it was a very powerful moment, my sobriety, because it taught me patience in a relationship with the distance that was imposed upon my wife and I, which was rare for me. And she had to kind of, you know, temper me a little bit on some of that, you know, because I was like all in day one. That's just kind of how I am sometimes. And I got to reconnect my children. I also had a very estranged relationship with my oldest son. When I moved back into the picture, he had kind of been, you know, a little bit of the provider, I guess you could say, emotionally to the younger siblings. And so me and him didn't see eye to eye real quick. And I did not behave probably as well as I should have to him. And it's been a very, very valuable lesson for me in dealing with my other children. And it's really interesting because my oldest son, he left when he was 16, basically, and went to live with some other family. We just butted heads. And this week, Tuesday, I'm going to be helping him move in to an apartment down south. We've totally repaired that relationship. We didn't talk for about a year, and then I saw him a couple times this senior year. I went, you know, to his graduation. We've had a distant, loving relationship, but very, very recently with some big things in his life, he's confided in me, and we have a healed relationship today. And that's miraculous. You know, that's miraculous. I have relationships with all of my children today. That in itself is miraculous. Quickly, you know, two things that I'll finish on. I'm sorry, I had a little bit of a hard time staying under the 35. You know, working the steps and doing all those meetings and going to the places to carry the message to the newcomer, I was really passionate about because I wanted to be in that place of sponsorship that I saw guys have. And I remember a guy checking me one time at a meeting and he said, you know, what step are you on? And I said, well, I'm getting ready to make my amends. He's like, well, be careful of what your desires are to sponsor. You know, our book's very clear about transmitting something you haven't got. You know, and he was right. You know, and I had to kind of check that a little bit and get myself through these steps and through this program. But I was always encouraged to go where the new man's at. I remember when I started this, I got involved with the book study about 6-7 years ago at the All-Star Sober House. And I've been a part of that book study off and on for the last 7 years. And reconnected the last couple of years pretty strong. It changes my life every time I get a guy that's calling and we're meeting and I'm walking somebody through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm then walking through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm maintaining my commitment to my sobriety of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the challenges in life that do come along, and they do. And it's really funny because we talk a lot about you know, being able to deal with the big ones, it's the little ones that really get us. And there's a lot of truth in that. You know, dirty coffee cup or my scissors being missing in the morning, man, that really, you know, that causes me some major angst. A couple years ago, my wife was diagnosed with a pretty significant illness, and it shook us. And there was definitely some tests there. And I think underlying it all was a deep faith in what the ultimate outcome was, for sure. And we knew what was necessary to get through it. That was also true. But in those moments, it was hard. There was definitely moments of me forgetting what was really going on and who it was really about. And there was a lot of practice in there of patience from both sides of the of that relationship. Now we look back, and it almost seems so long ago that we went through that. You know, it seems so long ago. And we did it with Alcoholics Anonymous. I think one of the coolest experiences we had during that time was we had a meeting in our living room, and we had a meeting in the hospital. And a bunch of friends showed up to be with us in the hospital and just to have a meeting. You know, it wasn't anything other than let's gather around, read chapter 5, and go around the room and connect. You know, I can't say enough about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You know, I'll finish with this. What was taught to me, and I've heard said, and I believe, is that there's three connections I have to maintain in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's I have to maintain a relationship with the literature. It's where the program's contained. I have to maintain a relationship with my higher power, and I have to maintain a relationship with the fellowship, and that's all of you and my sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. You guys are coming at this meeting. If you have a